welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 22nd of August, 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's the beginning of another glorious week in Blighty. The weather appears to have broken at last. Things have cooled down slightly, and we're here today, as always, to discuss the week's news, the news that is, that will be of interest to nationalists. And of course, as always, I have my co-host with me, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
I'm very well indeed. Thank you very much. Continuing to enjoy the global warming dividend, the warm weather that we've been having, which has been almost like continental weather for much of the week. But as you say, the weather seems to have broken a bit now. We've had some bits of rain over the course of this weekend so far, and it'll be interesting to see how the weather progresses here on in. I'm not a great believer that the global warming is entirely man-made. I think that a lot of the global warming is something which just happens. It just varies naturally. But we'll have to wait and see what happens. But we're in a situation where people are being priced out of all of their normal activities, where petrol prices have recently sort of gone through the roof and reached record highs. They've fallen back a bit since then, thankfully. We've also got the situation where gas prices have started to rise, apparently by sort of colossal amounts. I have to say, I haven't noticed that yet in any of the bills that I've received for my own personal gas. But, by all accounts, if we listen to the news, the gas is going up by sort of very, very large amounts. And I just think it's a great pity that that we didn't nationalise the North Sea gas industry when we had the opportunity to back in the 1970s, because that's been a great source of natural gas to Britain over the years, and by all accounts, from what I've been able to find out from my investigations, there still are some very substantial reserves of North Sea gas, such that if North Sea gas was devoted entirely to supplying the UK, that it could supply the UK's needs for almost the next 32 years. And so it is a great shame that instead of us being able to use our own gas and being able to ensure the supply of gas to our nation over the next 32 years, we're having to compete for gas on the international markets because the gas and electricity industries have been privatised rather, and it's as a result of the privatisation that there has been the creation of an international market for these things. And of course, instead of our government over the last sort of decades or so ensuring that UK needs took priority over the supply that was then sent to the continent and to other parts of the world, what's happened is that our supplies of North Sea gas have been absorbed into world supplies as a commodity, and we're now bidding for that commodity on the international markets. And because of the war in the Ukraine, it's meant that there is now a very sudden shortage of gas, and that's the cause of the price going up very markedly there. So we can blame the internationalism of governments over recent decades for the monstrous rise in the price of gas that we are being prepared for. Heaven knows what it will eventually be, because virtually every time you put the television on, it's going up by £1,000 a year, then it's going up by £2,000 a year, then it's going up by £3,000 a year, £4,000 a year, £5,000 a year. Where's it going to end? Are people eventually going to have to put 100% of their salaries into heating their homes? We'll have to wait and see. But I think that there will be quite a lot of civil unrest if the sort of price hikes that have been that are being anticipated actually do come to fruition. And it's a really, really poor time for ministers to be taking their holidays and swanning about in various coastal resorts around Europe, when in fact, they should be at work addressing this crisis to make sure that the British public don't suffer any more than we have to. It's very sad that that politicians aren't placed in, haven't got their priorities in the right place.
They certainly haven't. I mean, the gas has gone up by 95%. I think it's fuel or electric's gone up by 50%, and the other one's gone up by 45%. So 50% on fuel, 45% on electric, 95% on gas, which is really hitting the country hard. And I've got a little quote here. Pub, restaurant and business owners are being forced to close their doors as the crippling cost of living crisis continues to take hold over the country. Small businesses in particular have been unable to cope with the soaring cost of energy and food bills and are now calling for immediate government intervention. It comes as inflation hits double figures for the first time in 40 years, the highest it has been since 1982, at 10%. Now an estimated 45 million people will struggle to pay energy bills this winter with predicted rises in the price cap. The new study by the University of York shows that 18 million families will be left trying to make ends meet after further predicted rises in the energy price cap in October and January. And then there's a list of businesses that are now having to close down. I mean, obviously, if you're a private home, it's difficult enough paying the bills. But if you're running, a restaurant and you've got to keep the heating on, you're just not going to be able to make it pay. We're going to end up seeing all these businesses closing down because of the cost of this. And I'm sure that a large amount of this is still going in profits. It's still going in tax. We know that there's a 50% tax on fuel that goes to the government. They're trying to claw back the money that they wasted during COVID. So they'll be taking that back from these fuel costs. And this figure of 10% inflation, I think that's quite interesting as well, Max. That has some significance, doesn't it? This 10% figure with something?
It does have some significance because in recent podcasts that we've done, I've pointed to the fact that inflation is caused when there is a disproportionate increase in the money supply relative to the increase in the value of the goods and services that are available to be bought. And a bit of research that I did during this last week turns up these sort of interesting statistics that the M3 money supply, which is the supply of cash and coins, but plus also other near money in the form of electric money and in the form of government stocks and things of that sort. The M3 money supply in June 2019 was 2,873,320 million, so basically something like 3 billion. But the money supply went up over the next year between June 2019 and June 2020, went up by 10.6%. So it's interesting that there's a 10.6% increase in the money supply, and lo and behold, we're having inflation predicted at sort of 10.1%, an almost identical figure. But then in the further 2 years that have passed since June 2020, we've had the money supply going up by 6.1% and then by 6%. And so obviously between 2019 and 2020, which is the height of the pandemic, there was more money being created at that point in time. And that's why the inflation figure, sorry, the increase in M3 was larger between 2019 and 2020. So that is a statistic which supports the assertion that I make, that it's not that it is the increase in the money supply that causes inflation. And so therefore, only a decrease in the money supply can actually bring inflation under control. And of course, what the government is doing is, and what the Bank of England are doing, is they're increasing interest rates applying the old chestnut that by putting up interest rates, it's going to actually reduce inflation. But putting up interest rates doesn't reduce inflation. It just redistributes the money that is already circulating in the economy. Because instead of people having money in their pockets to spend, what happens is that wherever they've borrowed money, the cost of borrowing that money has risen, which means that as far as ordinary people are concerned, ordinary people are worse off when interest rates go up. But the people that are better off are banks, because banks, you know, if there's an increase in the money supply, sorry, an increase in the bank's base rate, as has happened between May 2022 and August 2022, there's been an increase from a 1% Bank of England base rate in May this year to 1.75. And what that means is that even where banks are only operating on the Bank of England base rate, for lending out the same amount of money, for having the same amount of money lent out, they're actually making 75% more in interest than they would have done in May this year. And so there's been a 75% increase in the money going into the banks. But what have the banks done to deserve that? The banks haven't done any, they've not improved their service to us, the customer. They haven't opened more bank branches so that it's easier for our people to go and visit a bank branch. They haven't increased the numbers of people they've been employing. In fact, they've been doing the opposite of that, but they've got this extra 75% of interest that they wouldn't have had beforehand. And that extra interest will inevitably be paid as dividends to the bank shareholders, and also will be paid as bonuses, because obviously, you know, the people who are the fat cats at the top of the banks, they're going to be saying, look at the profits we've made this year. We've made 75% more profit because the interest rates went up by 75%. And so therefore, we deserve to have a really big fat bonus for bringing all that extra money into the bank. And yet they've done nothing for it. And we've got Liz Truss, who is the the person most likely to become the Prime Minister, turning around and saying that she doesn't want the word profit to become a dirty word. Well, the word profit isn't a dirty word. And if you get a young couple who save and save for many years and manage to get together a deposit, and then they put down that deposit on a restaurant, they open the restaurant and they work 18 hours a day in order to build their little restaurant up, and they make a reasonable amount of profit. They may even make a very decent amount of profit and become higher rate taxpayers, but they will have grafted and they will have taken the risk of investing their own money in their business in order to generate that profit. And so that is a nice, clean profit that nobody would want to deny them. But where an organisation has done nothing to justify putting their prices up by 75%, especially where increasing those prices in that way is going to be causing a widespread hardship amongst the population generally, that's not nice, clean, well-earned profit. That's unearned profit. That's windfall profits that ought to be taxed with windfall taxes. And where it's not taxed with windfall taxes, and where people take that profit and they don't, and they do it irrespective of the fact that it's causing widespread hardship across the nation, that's profiteering. That's not profit, that's profiteering. The sort of thing that people, I think some people actually got shot for that during the Second World War. But that's another story. But profiteering shouldn't be allowed, and politicians shouldn't speak up in favour of people who are profiteers. If we look at gas and electricity, these are things that are going up in price. And we analyse what's taken place in our heating and our energy supplies over recent decades. I'm old enough to remember the days when my parents used to have a couple of sacks of coal delivered every so often, and that we would go and shovel that coal and put it on the fire in the lounge of the house that we had. And throughout the rest of the house, we didn't have any other form of heating, and so we used to have little paraffin gas heaters in some of the more far-flung parts of the house in order to heat the house, because it was too expensive in those days for most people to have central heating. And what happened was that during the 1970s that exploration for natural gas took place in the North Sea, and as I've already recounted to you, North Sea gas, the availability of North Sea gas brought the price of gas down, which then brought central heating into the reach of the common person. But now all that's being threatened, and it's being threatened by virtue of the fact that we're having to compete for the supply of gas, when in fact that gas should have been supplied to us first. And only any surplus gas that was surplus to our national needs should we have sold on to other countries. If we look at the gas and the energy industry that existed in the last century, In 1812, there was the formation of the Gas, Light and Coke Company, which was the very first company to start producing town gas, as it was called, on a large basis. And what they did, they took coal, they heated coal up, they superheated the coal so that it made the coal separate out into town gas and into coke. And there were some other derivatives as well that were sold off, chemical products that could be sold off. But primarily it was coke, and it was town gas that was produced by superheating the coal. That then changed in 1948, where instead of there being individual privately owned companies producing the gas and the electricity, that industry was nationalised by the Attlee government, and there was the creation of area gas boards, and there were 12 area gas boards covering the whole of the country. Eventually there was a national gas corporation that was created in 1972, around about the same time that the North Sea gas started to come in. And what existed at that particular point in time was that there were the North Sea gas producers, and there were the coal mines, and the coal mines supplied coal to a separate part of the British Gas Corporation, where the coal was converted into coke and into gas. But then, together with the North Sea gas, the town gas that was produced was then piped through a distribution network that covered the entire country, so that that gas could be piped to everybody's home, so that gas could be piped to everybody's business to provide for their heating needs and their commercial needs. And what's happened is that we've had this privatisation of the energy companies, and people have got confused on occasion, thinking, well, you know, if I switch from one producer to another producer, how do they actually bring about the change of supply, so that instead of me getting the ABC company's gas, I'm getting the XYZ company's gas? Well, there aren't separate networks of pipes. When you switch from the ABC energy company to the XYZ energy company, there isn't a separate supply of gas that you don't switch from one to switch. You switch to the other. There is just one gas pipe network covering the entire country. The same gas pipe network that existed in the days when the British Gas Corporation was there as a nationalised industry. The only difference that's made is that instead of people being billed by the British Gas Corporation for the gas that they consume, what now happens is that some people are billed by the ABC energy company, and other people are billed by the XYZ energy company. But the gas that they would use would be the same either way. It's just that the ABC Energy Company has been bidding on the international markets, the commodity markets, to buy gas, and the XYZ Energy Company has similarly been bidding on the international markets, the commodity markets, in order to buy gas. But not just competing between themselves here in the UK, they're having to compete with foreign countries who are also buying the gas, and so the price has gone up. And so we're in a situation where A, we're being fleeced by the banks, and B, we are increasingly now being fleeced by the energy companies. And the fleecing is taking place, firstly, to facilitate the privatisation of the energy companies, so that big profits can be made by companies that then supply backhanders to the Conservative Party to ensure that things don't ever get changed. And the same thing's happening with the banks. The banks are fleecing us. And if you ask a banker whether putting up interest rates is going to bring inflation down, they'll say, oh, yes, of course it will, because, you know, the longer they keep interest rates up, the fatter the profits they make, and the better off they are. But we're not better off for it. And this is why we need a socialist government. We need a government which is both nationalist and socialist, which ensures that the energy industry that exists in this country exists to cater for the energy needs of our people first, and to provide a stable supply of energy, a stable and affordable supply of energy first. And then only if there's any surplus left over should they then try and sell that at a profit abroad. We shouldn't be competing for gas and electricity on the international markets as commodities. And as far as banks are concerned, the bank should be honest enough to admit that it's only reducing the money supply that is going to bring down inflation. And instead of governments borrowing money into existence when they need to raise money, they should just print more banknotes or mint more coins. And so in that way, we'd have an increase in the money supply, which may be a short-term necessary evil, but at least we won't be massively increasing the debt that we have and that we owe and that we have to then pay back to the banks.
So, I mean, we've got two issues there, haven't we? We've got the banks, and I mean, they've basically failed us anyway with the money supply. We're in so much debt, we've got so many problems, and yet they're still being rewarded. And then we've got this privatisation thing. And I mean, what they've actually said, they said, well, we can't lower the prices for the fuel because that would mean that some of these smaller energy companies go bust. So they're putting these private energy companies' needs ahead of the public. When it used to just be British Gas, it's like British Telecom. It's the same thing there, isn't it? What they did, they privatised it all off, and now you've got Openreach that take care of all the lines themselves. But then you've got all these various different companies that then hire the lines out and sell these different packages, which puts the price up, and it means that the people that actually built this infrastructure in the first place, the indigenous British people, they're the ones that lose out. I mean, we built the gas infrastructure, and yet it is now owned by all these foreign companies thanks to privatisation. I mean, it was our inheritance. It was on our land. The gas is coming from our part of the North Sea. It was all built and all the pipelines were laid. Everything was done by our British ancestors. And now it's all been sold off to these foreign companies for them to make a profit. And now that the prices have gone up so high that we can't afford to heat our homes, they're doing nothing about it. And as you say, Max, we need a nationalist government that puts the needs of the people first. You do actually have that in Hungary. Hungary has refused to go along with these sanctions on Russia. They said, don't be so ridiculous. 90% of our gas comes from Russia. If we were to put sanctions on Russia, it would destroy our economy. There's no way we're going along with that. And they're still getting their gas through the Turkstream pipeline, I believe. So they're still getting all their gas from Russia. Whereas we've said, oh, no, we're going to put sanctions on Russia. We're going to prevent them from being able to sell their gas. And now you've got this Nord Stream 1 pipeline going into Germany, and it's only operating at 20% capacity. The reason for that is because it needs maintenance work doing. The turbines have been sent to Canada to be fixed. Canada can't get them fixed, can't send them back because of the sanctions. So it's not just going on in Britain, it's going on all the way across Europe. We've got this cost of living crisis, and it all goes down to the privatisation of all our natural resources. I mean, they've done the same with water, electricity, gas, all been privatised. We're all having to buy all of it in from abroad, and we're still selling it on the market. The British gas apparently has recently been found to have contaminants, radioactive contaminants, I did hear last week. But we've got all this North Sea oil, and we're just not using it. We're saying, well, we need to have green energy, so we're going to buy all this stuff in from abroad when it's our inheritance, it's our resources. It's the same as the food that we grow every year for ourselves. We need to be self-sufficient. We need to be looking out for the indigenous British people first, putting them first. And if you're not going to put them first, at least put the British citizens first, which is not what they're doing. They're just putting these profits for these private companies first, keeping the private companies afloat, when it would be a better idea just to nationalise them. And you can look at the British Rail as well. And look at the cost of that. I mean, it's cheaper to fly a plane than it is to get a train journey around Britain. And it's all because of the privatisation of it. And the standards of it is dreadful. When you look at the standards of the rail network in Europe, when you can travel between, you know, one capital city of Europe to another for very little money in very clean trains, all totally modern. And then you look at what's happening in Britain with the railways. It's just, you know, when you look at privatisation and you compare it to nationalisation, you think, well, actually, Jeremy Corbyn's idea of nationalising things, maybe that wasn't too bad. Any thoughts on that, Max?
Well, I think that, yes, that's a perfectly valid point to make. You know, particularly politicians, should be judged on the policies that they advocate, not just the policies they advocate, but the policies that they actually implement. For too long, as you say, our governments have been privatizing everything they can get their hands on, because the same thing's pretty much happening with the National Health Service. There's parts of the National Health Service that are absolutely falling apart. And what was a National Health Service has now been broken down into the sort of like the remnants of the National Health Service, plus a load of these health service trusts that exist, which are as good as a privatized industry anyway. You know, why we have to have these trusts where there are all these trustees and chairpersons, etc., that are all paid astronomically high salaries, all to do exactly the same thing. You know, it's the, somebody who's in charge of a health service trust in one part of the country is going to be doing identical work to the person who's in charge of a health service trust in another part of the country. They're not innovating. They're not sort of inventing new treatments or anything of that sort. All they're doing is making sure that everybody that works gets paid the appropriate amount of money, and that they recruit enough nurses or enough doctors to fill all the vacancies that they've got. You know, it's not rocket science. So why these people have to exist being paid phenomenally high salaries in order to compete? Because they're doing the same sort of work that could command a higher salary than they might otherwise be paid in Canada or in America. You know, we shouldn't be competing with Canada and America. We should be just be looking and seeing whether what somebody does is a worthwhile job, and if all they're doing is copying what everybody else at the same level as them in other health service trusts around the country do, why should we be paying them fat salaries to do that? Why shouldn't we pay, save the money and pay the higher salaries to the people that are actually providing the treatment, the nurses and the doctors and the cleaners and administration workers?
Well, you said maybe bring up the doctors there. I mean, they do say if you want to get this done quicker, you can always go private, and it's the same doctors that are doing it. It's the same doctors that are doing the private stuff. So there's encouraging people to actually go private, and then you can move from there to the dentists. And dentistry is in such a state in Britain now that we've got people that have got waiting lists 6 months to a year to be seen by an NHS dentist. I mean, it was on the edges of completely collapsing before we had the COVID lockdown. And then when we had the COVID lockdown, nobody was able to get their teeth seen to for 2 years. And now that they've opened back up again, you just can't get your teeth seen. You cannot get your teeth checked on the NHS anymore. When I was a child, it was all paid for. Dentistry was all paid for. Everybody's teeth was looked after. You went there to have your checkup. If you needed anything doing, it was all done on the NHS. They didn't really have a private dentistry, and now they're just pushing to have everybody have to actually pay for their dental work, you have to have functional teeth in order to eat. It's like you have to have functional eyes in order to see, to be able to work. And yet the dentistry is so falling apart. We've got people that are now pulling out their own teeth. We've got people that are in pain. I mean, unless they say, well, unless you've got swelling and bleeding, then they're not interested in actually seeing you. And the NHS dentists that are operating, they've got lists of thousands of people that are on their books. Nobody can come in for a regular checkup. If you pay to go private, I mean, even that's causing a problem as well. This has all been in the news recently. I mean, our medical services are all on the verge of collapse, basically. And a lot of it has to be down to immigration and new people that have been coming into the country. You think you've got 15 to 20% extra people in the country, and at the same time you're cutting back on dentistry, you're cutting back on medical services, trying to tighten the belt, as it were, but yet we've still got new people coming in all the time that are expecting to get treatment on the NHS, which is costing a fortune. And of course that they will then try and say, well, privatisation is the solution, isn't it? We'll privatise it, and we'll do it in a sneaky way, because of course the Conservatives will always say, no, we won't privatise the NHS. But then they'll set up these private trusts, and they'll set up I forget what it is, some way that people have to actually get loans, so it's sort of half private, half NHS, and it's all a sneaky way of just privatising everything, all the things that the Indigenous British people built for their descendants, to try and make life better for their descendants, are now being sold on the open market, and we're being forced to compete with the rest of the world instead of, as you say, Max, just competing amongst ourselves within a homogenous community where everything roughly costs the same amount. So if you actually earn a profit, a good profit, then it's because you've actually put the work in there, rather than because you've managed to get it from some sweatshop somewhere in India, or you've managed to cut the price somewhere. It's just made everything far worse for everyone. And I mean, you can tie it all into globalization as well, can't you? Globalization, privatization, all of it. It's totally anti-nationalist, and this is where we've ended up now with this cost of living crisis. Any final thoughts on that, Max?
And there are hospitals where the waiting list to see a doctor, or the waiting time to see a doctor if you go into accident and emergency is like 6 hours plus. So if you're in an absolute emergency, you can go in there and you may be seen straight away, but then it will perhaps take you an hour before you then see the next doctor. It may be an hour before you see the next doctor. Now, it may be that you're not likely to die within the next minute or two when you go in there with your emergency. But the point is that people can, once they've been triaged, when they first go into the accident emergency and the triage nurse decides, oh, this is a medium urgency case, and so therefore you get designated as that and you get put in the line where the doctor's going to see you in, say, 3 hours' time. It could be that during that three-hour period that you could have a downturn in your situation, and you could be then become a very urgent case. And very often these accident and emergency departments of hospitals are understaffed, and very often they're staffed by people who are foreign doctors, many of which have got English as a second language, and so therefore don't necessarily understand what is being said to them by the patients that go in there. And there are hospitals, King's Lynn Hospital has been in the news in recent times, where the hospital's got hundreds of props all around the hospital holding the ceilings up, because the building is so old now and so in need of repair. I think large parts of the building were kind of prefabricated when houses were prefabricated at the end of the Second World War, and nothing's been upgraded since then. And so if you go into King's Lynn Hospital, you'll see that there are all these metal props, the same sort of props that were used in coal mines to hold the ceilings up in coal mines. They're all around the hospital, all around the walls. There are all these props, almost like columns. You know, if they made the columns wide enough and put Doric elaborations and things around the bottoms and the top to make them look more attractive, it could almost be like walking into a Greek temple or something, with all the ornamental columns. But these aren't ornamental columns; these are props that have been erected to hold the ceiling up, because otherwise the ceiling would collapse. And it was in the news recently that an operation had to be paused because the doctors noticed that part of the ceiling was coming adrift and was likely to fall down on top of them. So they had to clear out of that that operating theatre and bring in maintenance men to stick a few more props up to hold that bit of the ceiling up again. You know, it's in every possible service that used to be a national service. After the Second World War, lots of industries and lots of services around the UK were nationalised, because it was seen that having a nationalised industry was the most efficient way of running an industry. And what's happened is that over the last 50 or 60 years, that those nationalised industries that used to be relied upon have been privatised, and through privatisation, the service that they provide has been turned into a commodity. And instead of that service being provided as a priority to the British people, it's a service that's available on the open market around the world, where we then have to compete with foreign countries for those services that are being provided, all the products that are being provided. And it's been to the detriment of our people. And if gas prices go up by the degree that has been indicated between now and January next year, I think that the government will be very lucky if there isn't if there aren't riots and disorder among the population, because people's standard of living will have been reduced to an unacceptably low degree, to the point where people will not be able to afford to heat their homes. People will have to turn off their central heating systems, and that means then that when they and their children wake up in the mornings, they'll have to scrape the frost off the inside of their bedroom windows before they can look out. And they'll have to wear extra layers of clothing and huddle together, and perhaps two generations sleeping together in the same bed, huddled together, will become a norm again in the way that it was during the very harrowing times that existed way back in the before the First World War, when there was real poverty in certain parts of this country, and that poverty is likely to return, and I don't think people are going to stand for it.
Yeah, we won't be in a recession. We'll be entering into a depression. I can recall having to wait 16 hours at the hospital in accident and emergency. It's not uncommon that you can end up waiting there all night before you see the doctor the next day. And you think, go back in time just a century, and the sun didn't set on the British Empire. And now look at us. Now look at the state of us. Well, shall we go back to more glorious times and look at one of our greatest Britons, do you think, Max?
Yes, that would be great.
Yes, let's talk about Sir Flinders Petrie, who we began talking about in the last episode. We talked about how Petrie had no formal education, but expressed a keen interest in archaeology from an early age, being horrified at 8 years old when he saw how a Roman villa was being excavated with shovels instead of carefully brushing through the debris. Sir Francis Galton, in particular, was impressed with Petrie's intellectual capacity, as he was able to visualise a sliding rule and use it to make calculations. He produced the most accurate survey of Stonehenge to a tenth of an inch before heading off to Egypt, where he was appalled to see the way ancient monuments were being worn away by the weather and not being cared for by the Arabs. And he referred to Egypt as a country on fire because of this, and he wanted to excavate and catalogue as much as he could before it was all gone and before he was gone. His workmen liked him because rather than getting them to dig as fast as they could and find large bits of treasure, he wanted them to go slowly and find small but significant finds. Upon finding many ancient portraits, he was furious to find the Cairo Museum director had left them to the elements in the yard of the museum. So he left them with just 12 and took the other 48 with him for an exhibition at London Museum. And we talked about the importance of the London Museum and the importance of taking these relics away from the countries that they were in, because they were just not being looked after by the people there. He was paid £250 a month for his expenses by University College London, and he was made professor at the Egyptology chair there by Amelia Edwards, who was the patron. Now, she did not provide the funds, as we said last time, but she helped to promote the work of the Egyptology department because she was a famous author. And that's where we got up to last time. Any thoughts on that, Max? Do you want to add anything to that?
Well, just really that it was a different time to the time we're living in today. It was a time when our people, particularly British people who were of superior ability and superior intellect, were able to go out around the world and were able to do good work, not just in extending the British Empire, but in the countries to which the British Empire extended. They were able to do things that would increase mankind's knowledge and increase our understanding of the changes that have taken place throughout the historic and prehistoric periods, and so provide us with the information that we would need in order to look forward into the future and to set ourselves challenging goals for the future as well. But none of that happens nowadays.
It was a golden age of archaeology, really, in the days of the British Empire, because we could go into these lands and nobody had looked into these old ruins before or dug things up. I mean, Petrie would just look around and he would almost have a sixth sense. He would say, look, this is the area that we want to dig around in, and he'd end up finding a tomb there. And this was in Egypt, in India, in Palestine, all over the place, especially after the First World War and up to the First World War. There's so many things were discovered, discovering the ruins of Troy out there in Turkey as well. Sleeman, I think, was the name of the character that did that. And he worked with Petrie at one point as well. Well, we are going to leave Egypt now and head over to Palestine for a bit. In 1890, Petrie made the first of his many forays into Palestine, leading to much important archaeological work. His six-week excavation of Tel el-Hizi, which was mistakenly identified as Lachish, that year represents the first scientific excavation of an archaeological site in the Holy Land. Petrie surveyed a group of tombs in the Wadi al-Rababa, or the biblical Hinnom of Jerusalem, largely dating to the Iron Age and the early Roman periods. And I think this is because it was under a British administration. Palestine was under British administration after the Ottomans, and that's why he could go there and dig around and do the archaeological work. And since Israel has taken over Palestine, it's been very difficult to do this archaeological work because the Jews have this religious thing where you're not allowed to dig around or disturb Jewish remains, which is why there isn't any digging around that's done in any of the work camps from the Second World War. But before that was actually taken over, the administration by the Jews, there was a lot of digging around that was done by Petrie and by other archaeologists, and they found a lot of interesting stuff there. I mean, he was looking at the Iron Age and early Roman periods. I think he was the first actually to show that the Romans, or evidence of the Romans in parts of Egypt. Any comments on that, Max?
Only just to endorse what you said and the scope that it opened up for Flinders Petrie and for other archaeologists of the time.
And also, don't forget, he'd had this Christian background as well. He'd been brought up with a Christian background, so he knew the Bible well. So he had an idea of what he was looking at, what he was looking for, and how it fitted in with the biblical narrative. Well, the next year, in 1891, he went back to Egypt, and this time he went to Tel el Amarna, which is the city of Akhenaten. Everybody's probably heard of Akhenaten, the weird looking pharaoh with the long stretched face, and he got rid of all the old gods and told all the Egyptians that they had to worship this new god that he had created, the Aten. So he was the equivalent of an atheist, basically getting rid of all the old gods. And when he actually died, the Egyptians defaced all the images of him and they destroyed his city and it got covered with sand. Well, that was found again. I forget exactly when it was discovered. And Petrie went there to look at the Temple of Aten, and he discovered a 300 square foot New Kingdom painted pavement of garden and animals and hunting scenes. And this became a tourist attraction. But as there was no direct access to the site, the tourists ended up wrecking the neighbouring fields on their way to it. This made the local farmers deface the paintings, and it is only thanks to Petrie's copies that their original appearance is known. So there's two things here. These archaeological digs, I mean, if you think archaeological digs today, they would all be cordoned off. The public wouldn't be able to look at what was happening. But back then, it was a tourist attraction. These archaeologists that were digging around and discovering these amazing things that we didn't know about from thousands of years ago, especially in Mesopotamia, all the tourists would go there to watch, to see what was happening and to meet the archaeologist and shake his hand. I mean, they were the equivalent of the pop stars or the movie stars of today, these archaeologists, because of the stuff that they were doing, the information that they were getting, these wonderful treasures that they were actually finding. So it was a tourist attraction at the time. And then you get these local farmers, and they actually defaced the relics. They actually destroyed these paintings. So it's only thanks to Petrie's copies that their appearance is known. And when I was looking this up on Wikipedia, it was saying citation needed. So, and it said that in quite a few places, but the citations are very easy to actually find, and these things did happen. So if you can imagine that, the farmers defaced the paintings. It's rather like you know, as if the Greeks like smashed up the marbles because the tourists were coming to look at them. Terrible. Any comments on that, Max?
And that's why these civilizations crumbled and fell away, because there was a change in the populations. And this is one of the things that people don't appreciate when we campaign against uncontrolled mass immigration into Europe, that if the founding race of a nation or of a civilization ceases to be in the majority and in fact dwindles away and perhaps becomes extinct, so the ability to maintain that civilization disappears with them. And the civilization falls into rack and ruin. And that's why, you know, we have so many sites around the Middle East that were created by warrior elites that had invaded down into that area from Europe and that had created those civilizations, where the civilization has eventually crumbled as a result of the race mixing that took place between the warrior elite that created the civilization and the mass of people who lived in that country, who would have, many of whom would have just been slaves initially. Why those civilizations crumbled away and why there is no appreciation of their value or their grandeur by many of the current populations of those countries.
Well, this is one of the things that Petri noticed. He noticed that when the civilization was at its great heights, he noticed that there was a particular racial type that was there, the Nordic racial type. And he noticed that when the civilization was starting to crumble, it was all these mixed race types that he referred to as mulatto types at the time. He actually collected different representations of them, different skulls. He measured them. We'll get into that in a bit. And he came out with a theory, the racial theory of civilization, that there is a civilization-bearing race. They create the civilization. The other races then come into that civilization. There is interbreeding, and then the civilization crumbles, and it's like a cycle. And then the bearers of the civilization move on to somewhere else, the ones that didn't interbreed with the other races, and they create the civilization again. And he was one of the first people to actually posit this theory, which has then gone on since then to be talked about. And now, of course, they try to debunk it. They say that civilization, it just diffuses. Wherever there is a civilization, it diffuses to the other peoples. And that's how it travels around the world, rather than saying there is actually a particular race that do this. But the evidence does show that there is a particular race. We'll get into that in a bit. We'll just talk for now about his greatest discovery, which was the Merneptah Stelae. In early 1896, Petri and his archaeological team were conducting excavations on a temple in Petri's area of concession at Luxor. This temple complex was located just north of the original funerary temple of Amenhotep III, which had been built on a floodplain, and they were initially surprised that this building, which they were excavating, was also attributed to Amenophis III, since only his name appeared on blocks strewn all over the site. Could one king have had two mortuary temples? Petri dug and soon solved the puzzle. The temple had been built by Merneptah, or Merimptah, the son and successor of Ramesses II, almost entirely from stones which had been plundered from the temple of Amenophis III nearby. Statues of the latter had been smashed and the pieces thrown into the foundations. Fragments of couchant stone jackals, which must have once formed an imposing avenue approaching the pylon, and broken drums gave some idea of the splendour of the original temple. A statue of Merneptah himself was found, the first known portrait of this king, but better was to follow. Two splendid stelae were found, both of them usurped on the reverse side by Merneptah, who had then turned them to face the wall. One, beautifully carved, showed Amenophis III in battle with Nubians and Syrians. And that's a very famous picture there. You can see the racial characteristics of the Nubians, you can see the racial characteristics of the Syrians, and you can see Amenophis III with his bow and arrow smashing the hell out of them. I mean, it's quite a famous picture, or quite a famous stelae. The other, of black granite, was over 10 foot high. Larger than any stelae previously known, the original text commemorated the building achievements of Amenophis and described the beauties and magnificence of the temple in which it had stood. When it was turned over, an inscription of Merneptah was revealed, recording his triumphs over the Libyans and the peoples of the sea. And the peoples of the sea, I think, were the Philistines. Wilhelm Spiegelberg, a noted German philologist, came over to read it. And near the end of the text, he was puzzled by one name, that of a people or tribe whom Meneptah had victoriously smitten. Isriah, he said. It was Petri whose quick imaginative mind leapt to the solution. Israel. Spiegelberg agreed that it must be so. Won't the reverends be pleased, was his comment. At dinner that evening, Petri prophesied, this stele will be better known in the world than anything else that I have found. It was the first mention of the word Israel in any Egyptian text, and the news made headlines when it reached the English papers. During the field season of 1895 to 1896 at the Ramesseum, Petri and the young German Egyptologist Wilhelm Spiegelberg became friends. Spiegelberg was in charge of the edition of many texts discovered by his British colleague, and Petri offered important collections of artifacts to the University of Strasbourg. In 1897, the Kaiser Wilhelms Universität Strasbourg gratefully conferred to Petri the title of Doctor Honoris Causa, and in June 1902, he was elected a Fellow of the Royal Society. So this really put him on the map, discovering this this stele here with Israel on it, the first time that that had actually been seen in any Egyptian work, which basically confirmed the bit in the Bible where it talks about this particular pharaoh smashing the Israelites. And here we had the proof that it actually happened. And we also get lots of racially accurate images from this time as well, which also made its mark on Petri, because he was starting to understand that you know, all these races had been known about in the ancient world. They knew about racial differences, and they basically had nations that were based upon race. The Libyans weren't a group of Libyan citizens, they were a group, a particular racial type, the same as the Nubians were a particular racial type, the Syrians were a particular racial type, and the Egyptians were against them. And you could see in the pictures that they were these particular types that the Egyptians were actually fighting against. Any thoughts on that, Max?
I think it's just very interesting that, you know, these things can be tied in. And lots of things that often get regarded as being myth get dismissed as being just mere myths. But if once you're able to use knowledge to tie myths in with actual concrete artifacts, or solid rock artifacts in this case, it enables us to make a lot more sense of history.
Well, it's like when Woolley discovered Ur of the Chaldees in Mesopotamia as well. I mean, all these things have been sort of read about in the Bible, these various cities from the Iron Age, but nobody had actually found any evidence of them. And then these British archaeologists went out there, dug around in the sand and said, well, this is it. Here's the evidence of it. You know, this great city, Nineveh, that they found, the capital of the Assyrian Empire. As I say, this Ur of the Chaldees and these glorious tombs with all these gold and all these ornate, very, very ornate relics that they actually found. There was one, I think it was titanium, a gold helmet that one of these kings had, and you could even see all the hairs on it. It was, yeah, electrum plated gold helmet. And they say that was from 3000 BC. I'm of the opinion that it's more likely to be 2000 BC, but incredibly intricate artifacts that they actually found that bore out a lot of the history, or a lot of the places that were mentioned in the Old Testament that nobody had any idea, I mean, that they actually existed before. You know, there was a question, did these places actually exist? And these British archaeologists, they found that they did exist, and they found the evidence for them. Well, from 1889 to 99, Petri directed a team excavating over 17 cemeteries containing numerous graves between Hugh and Abidiah, Egypt. The dig team included Beatrice Orme, David Randall McIver, Arthur Cruttendon Mace, Henrietta Laws, and Hilda Petri, his wife. Pre-dynastic, Old Kingdom, Middle Kingdom, and Roman graves were excavated and published at Diospolis Parva. So those cemeteries must have stretched back over 1,000 years, maybe longer than that, to find these Roman graves. He did find a lot of evidence of the Romans in Egypt, which we're very thankful for. But also, I mean, pre-dynastic here, Old Kingdom, Middle Kingdom, it must have like really opened up our understanding of what prehistory was like. basically when we went over there. I think it was Napoleon that first went into Egypt, and he was the first to dig around. But it was really this period here with Flinders Petrie that opened it all up. And after him, it was Howard Carter with Tutankhamun. Any thoughts on that, Max?
I was just listening to what you're saying. It's interesting that these things, remains from these graves were published at Diospolis Parva. I was just thinking where that would actually be. It would just be interesting to know that.
Dio is God, isn't it? So it would be something to do with that, Diospolis Parva. It's probably somewhere in Egypt. That character that we were talking about last time that left the paintings outside, or the portraits outside rather, that was the museum director in Cairo. That was the Arab museum director that did that didn't have any care for them.
I was just going to say, when you think that these the time span of these places that were being excavated ranged from pre-dynastic times all the way through to Roman times, you know, that would have been a period of perhaps 3,000 or 4,000 years, I would think, and so there must have been created an absolutely immense amount of artifacts and remains over very extensive areas of land must exist. And so for somebody to go to Egypt and study Egyptology, there must be more there to actually study than you could perhaps even study in a lifetime, I would imagine.
Yes, you have to remember as well, he was the first to determine exactly what time period these bodies were being found in, and he did that by the pottery, and nobody had thought of doing that before, looking at the textures and the styles that were on these pottery shards, and then dating exactly what time period it was that these bodies had been found in. And that's one of the great innovations that he actually made. Now, I mentioned earlier about his links to Francis Galton, Carl Pearson, and Biometrica, and I've got these notes from various articles that have been written basically trying to run him down and saying that he was a racist, he was a eugenicist, and I wanted to just get the information on what his contribution was to the eugenicist movement, and so that's where these bits come from. So they're a bit technical, but it gives us an idea of how involved he was with Sir Francis Galton and Carl Pearson. Petrie had been marked out by Galton as a literally visionary mathematician in his Inquiries into Human Faculty of 1883, and Galton had persuaded the Royal Society to fund Petrie's first major publication, The Pyramids and Temples of Giza, in 1883. In 1886, when Petrie was commissioned to take racial photographs from the ancient Egyptian pictures and sculptures by a British Association for the Advancement of Science committee chaired by Galton, the £20 awarded was little more than a token, and Galton funded the expedition from his own private resources. The result was a collection of 150 casts of 268 heads, 40 photographs, and further photographs of the casts with notes by Petrie identifying these different heads of people, usually from towns in now Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, Iraq, and Israel, differentiating them all and identifying them into different racial types. Some of these casts were exhibited as Syrian heads at the South Kensington Museum under the auspices of the Palestinian Exploration Fund, and they had an afterlife as illustrations in philologist A.H. Sayce's Races of the Old Testament, 1891, a popular publication marketed as a gift book or a Sunday school prize book. The casts were donated to the British Museum, and it was thought that the Petrie Museum did not own any of the casts or material from racial photographs. And I find this absolutely fascinating. It shows you that there is many, many subtle differences between races. And he could get these individuals and say, well, these are a perfect representation of this particular racial group. And then the pictures of that were put into a Bible book, a Sunday school book that was a prize for people going to Sunday school. I mean, everybody knew about race back then. It wasn't seen as a bad thing. And it was seen as this was vital to our understanding of history, is the races that were involved in it. Now, in 1902, Petrie published a graph of triangles indicating skull size, shape, and racial ability. In the same year, a paper on Naccada crania that had been excavated by Petrie's team in 1894-95 was published in the anthropometric journal Biometrica, which played an important part in the methodology of cranial measuring in biometrics and helped establish Carl Pearson's biometric laboratory at University College London. So basically the skulls that he dug up in Naccada, he was measuring them to get the skull size, and then he was working out what their racial ability was, what their intelligence was from the skull size. And they were using that with the statistics in Biometrica. Cicely D. Fawcett's and Alice Lee's paper on the variation and correlation of the human skull used the Naccada crania to argue for a controlled system of measurement of skull size and shape to establish homogeneous racial groups, patterns of migration, and evolutionary development. So from measuring the skull size, they could say, this has to be part of this racial group, and this is where that racial group was heading, and this is how far they have evolved, basically, from earlier races. Their work was more cautious in tone and judgment than Petrie's pronouncements on the racial origins of the early Egyptians, but both the graph and the paper illustrated shared ideas about skull size, shape, statistical analysis, and the ability and a need to define race. And Petrie was correct about the racial origins of the early Egyptians, but he was, a little bit more excited about things than the actual, than these scientists were. His belief in biological determinism and racial hierarchy was informed by earlier ideas and current developments in anthropometrics and eugenics. The combination of international agreements on measurements and collection of data from skulls alongside Galton's sophisticated statistical analysis led to a greater importance placed on anthropometric measurements and the potential of this to plot human evolutionary development. In 1902, Petrie published his graph in Man, a journal published by the Anthropological Institute of Great Britain and Ireland, showing the cranial sizes of various different groups of people from skulls in the collection of the Royal College of Surgeons, London. This paper on the use of diagrams was an exercise in the applied use of three-dimensional graphs through the mapping of triangles of three indices of skull sizes on a diagram of climate and intelligence of races. The triangular measurements were taken from the dimensions of skulls, the capacity, width, and height, and these were also illustrated in the paper. This 3D diagram visualizes the statistics of skull measuring, as well as so-called racist assumptions about skulls, brain size, and intellectual ability. Petrie's diagram utilized Lamarckian ideas about climate and environment affecting biological difference in human beings, as well as reflecting established racially determinist views of civilization and intelligence. The emphasis on skulls as the main indicators of this supposed biological difference was typical of Petrie's ideas around race, but far from unique to him. However, what was unique was Petrie's relationship with the polymath scientist Francis Galton, statistician Carl Pearson, and his contribution to the establishment of biometrics as a tool of scientific analysis at University College London. And of course, what he was doing there is all, it's been proved correct since the advent of IQ tests. When you look at the brain size and you look at the skull size and you can see that you're able to fit more of a brain in there, those sorts of people end up having a higher IQ. And also the, if there's more folds in the brain as well, that means that they're going to have a higher IQ. Max, any thoughts on this? Because you're very interested in Galton and Pearson, aren't you?
Yeah, if you look at human evolution, it begins with specimens that have been found, particularly in Africa, that were pre-human types, and what were generally regarded as Australopithecines, and then there have been types of Australopithecine that have been found, Homo habilis, and then Homo erectus, and and then more modern types beyond that, Neanderthals and anatomically modern humans and Denisovans. And it's interesting that people nowadays very often try to debunk all of this and say, oh, this is just all wrong. But to my mind, a lot of the teachings of people like Francis Galton and Flinders Petrie, it's self-evident. If you look at the line of human evolution, what you see all the way through is skull size becoming larger and larger and larger. And it's not just the size of the skull, it's the size of the cranium, the part of the skull that encases the brain, becomes larger and larger, so that a larger brain can be accommodated. And this has, since time immemorial, been regarded as an indication of increasing intelligence. Because the earliest Australopithecines had brains around about the same sort of size as a chimpanzee, and the brain sizes have just got larger and larger to the point where you get to the Homo erectus types, where they've got a skull of around about sort of 1200 cc's in volume. And then when you look at the skulls of Neanderthals and you look at the skulls of anatomically modern humans, you find that the people of those two types that existed perhaps 40 or 50,000 years ago, those skulls have reached a cranial capacity of around about 1,750 cc's. But then since that peak of the last great glaciation, what's happened is that average skull sizes have tended to diminish over time. The rationale for that is that prior to the invention of writing, people had to remember where they were. They had to remember the positions of the stars in the sky. They had to remember the paths taken by their prey animals at various seasons throughout the year. They had to remember which plants that they found that were edible, which plants that they found were not edible. And so the survival of human groups in those days depended upon there being a significant number of people within that group who had an absolutely massive capacity to hold information it's considerably in excess of what people need to hold in their heads today. Nowadays, if somebody wants to know a piece of information, they go on the internet and they have a look, and it's somewhere. You can find it on the internet, on the superhighway, information superhighway. That was what I was struggling for. So on the information superhighway, people don't have to remember things any longer in the way that they had to in the past. And I think that particularly when you look at people who have been regarded as polymaths, like Francis Galton and Darwin and Flinders Petrie, these sort of people, I'm sure if you measured their skulls, they would have had larger than average skull sizes, and they would be people who would be more directly descended from the people who had the large brain, large cranial capacities from the last glaciation. Although it wouldn't have been necessary for them to remember as much, because writing had been invented, that they still retained the capacity to become polymaths and to hold in their heads massive amounts of information and to be able to regurgitate that information at will, effectively. And so there always has been, in my opinion, a correlation between brain size and intelligence. When you study the various the skulls of people of various races around the world, there are differences, average differences in brain size, and so therefore there must be average differences in intellect and intelligence between races.
He did actually donate his head to science when he died because of all this interest in brain sizes. But, I mean, you couldn't be an archaeologist digging around and looking at these various stages of civilization without becoming fascinated by race and by the different types of human being that you were finding amongst the different stages of the civilization. I mean, he had to become an ethnologist or a racial scientist at the same time as being an archaeologist. It must have been absolutely fascinating for him to discover that thousands of years ago, there were white people that were in Egypt. The same as it was fascinating to find evidence that thousands of years ago, there were white people that were in India. If you think 500 years before that, we just thought that we'd been in Europe. And I guess people just assumed that the Israelites were white. But then to go all the way out to Egypt, all the way out to India, and find that these civilizations had actually been created by people that looked exactly the same as Northern Europeans look today, it must have been absolutely incredible for them. I think he's a fantastic Greatest Briton for us to study. But I think we should leave that here for today, Max. So I'll say thank you very much for coming on today.
That's been a great pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope that you have a great week ahead of you.